Dark wings.
Dork words.
A Game of Thrones podcast.
Episode 17. Science fiction. Act 3. Welcome everyone to our final science fiction episode. I am your host, Chuck Davis, and with me, as always, are
Brendan J.D. Riley,
Molly Welsh,
and Eric Salonis.
Alright, so we're going to wrap up our sci-fi discussion with all things television, because there's so much great sci-fi on television. I know there's a great deal of enthusiasm for Battlestar Galactica, among others, that we're excited to talk about. But before we do so, let's get a little Game of Thrones business out of the way first. First and foremost, in the world of Game of Thrones news, is Peter Dinklage receiving the Golden Globe for Best Supporting Actor in a... What's the category?
Science fiction show. No.
Miniseries or draw or something. Or
in an HBO series with nudity.
That's right.
Dink for the win.
And he had an excellent acceptance speech. He was cool. The right amount of thanking the producers and agents. And right amount of humility and right amount of wit. He was a miniature George Clooney. He probably wouldn't appreciate that.
As he is.
He gave a shout out, it's more respectful than a shout out, thanking George R. R. Martin for creating the world in which he gets to embody this character. So I'm reinventing the words that he said. Whatever he said was was pretty great.
Look up some YouTube clips.
But it's cool. It's cool that he thanked George R. R. Martin in particular. It's pretty rare, I think, especially in a TV series for a writer. They usually just say, and thanks to the writers for the great words that they give us.
Yeah.
Well, but in this case, it's cool that there's a singular creator. Mm-hmm. I read one of George R. R. Martin's blog posts, where he talked about the great night he had hanging out with the producers and actors and stuff that were actually there at the event. So,
wow.
I'm pretty sure he was at one of the back tables that the cameras never quite swing around that far to see who's in the back of the room.
When I was in Chicago with Arch and Amy, we totally thought we saw George R. R. Martin at this restaurant.
I vaguely remember there was
a really big table of people, and we were like, no fucking way. That's George R. R. Martin. Arch kept getting up and doing weird poses next to signs, and we kept pretending to take pictures of him. We were really taking pictures of this dude who looked just like George R. R. Martin. And I don't think that it was.
You should put the pictures online and see.
That's right. You have photographic evidence.
Yeah.
I do. It makes sense that he thanked George R. R. Martin because, like, why are we sitting around a table talking about all this? Because he's created these brilliant... And Tyrion is one of the best characters in the entire series. Like, the dude never stops moving. He never stops experiencing things. Like, it's great.
He never stops getting people to want to kill him. It's wonderful.
Tyrion is one of the best, and I bet it is really cool to play Tyrion and make him even better.
Totally. So, yeah. Hear, hear. Yeah, and I can't wait to talk to you guys about Tyrion and his exploits in A Dance with Dragons.
How far?
Which I'm 44 pages away from the end of the book.
Hey. Oh my god! Yeah. So, wait, have you read the last Arya chapter?
I believe I have.
Dude! I cried all the way through that chapter, all the way through it, because it was so very epic.
All of it is good.
The new trailer for season 2 is coming out soon. I've seen a video post that was like, the new trailer is coming soon, and it was like a trailer for the trailer. It was kind of awkward, I don't know. And Eric hosted a Game of Thrones board night. Tell us about that.
Yes, Eric and the other Eric and I hosted a Game of Thrones board game night last night, actually, and it was all kinds of fun. It's a very cool game. It's very strategy based. Basically, it's a huge fold out board. Covers like the almost a lot of the table has like the entire map of like Westeros on it. The one sad thing is that there's nothing with the Eastern continent with Dany or anything like that. So you're dealing entirely with Westeros. But you can have up to six players, and basically, the way it sort of plays out, it's interesting because there's very little, there's a little bit of chance in it, in that there's certain cards that are drawn, but the cards all tend to do like the same sorts of things, just in different variations. But as far as the actual gameplay goes, as far as like marching on other people's lands and that sort of thing, it's there's like no die rolling involved or anything like that. The chance comes entirely from you don't know what your other opponents are going to do. And so you could play a card that could be very powerful against a certain situation, but if your opponent plays a certain move that is it could totally fuck you over and just backfire against you. And so you can support other characters, like you can form alliances temporarily and that sort of thing. I ended up playing as the Tyrells.
I think of it as Tyrell. When you say Tyrell,
I've heard it pronounced two different ways, and so I'm curious how they're going to, because we haven't met. Do they have any of them in the series so far? I'm curious how they're going to pronounce it in the series.
What about Sir Loras? He's a Tyrell.
Is that what they say in them?
I don't remember if they said Tyrell or Tyrell. Anyway,
I just remember this.
I like Tyrell. Yes.
Yeah. I said that I actually, because I was them. Loras is one of the character like that you can play, and I said that I wanted his ability to say like. Can make gratuitous sucking noises off camera.
I wonder if that was a Foley artist.
But Eric ended up playing as the Lannisters, and of course he won the fucking game.
Really?
Yeah, and what's interesting about the different character cards is, like, for instance, you can have a really powerful character like Tywin Lannister, like has like huge, he adds like huge strength to whatever. But then there's like characters like Cersei. She doesn't add any strength to an attack, but when you play her in an attack, she basically removes somebody else's thing that they've done. So
she
like,
negates something.
Yeah, she negates something
she's
else.
She's having
that's going
sex
on.
With them somewhere. There are a bunch of dudes who, actually, a lot of them were on our very first episode. Greg Precht, all the dudes that came in costume that first night, and Hobbs and Arch and those guys went on a ski trip a couple weeks ago, and there's a photo of them playing the Game of Thrones board game from the loft of this cabin or something, you know, and there's like six dudes sitting around all like drinking and like with their, you know, faces covered, like strategy game, and Greg Precht was House Stark and he won the whole thing.
Oh, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice to know they can win in an alternate universe.
Yeah, right.
I came this close to winning in the 11th hour of the game, basically. I think I played it up as the Tyrells by being, like, I was kind of isolated for a while and just bided my time by, like, gaining power tokens, basically. And then I ended up forming, actually, an alliance halfway through the game with Stannis Baratheon, actually. And we sort of claimed the south together, and then the Lannisters started pushing us down. And then I tried to win in the final round by fucking over my alliance with the Baratheons, but then Eric ended up as the Lannister playing the Tywin card, and it just caused my entire plan to backfire.
A Tywin card can,
do individual characters live and die in the game, or are they just like,
no? They're just cards they're playable cards that help your attack at certain points, basically.
Okay,
sort of
but
thing.
So there's you can never like kill Cersei or any particular person.
No. Sadly, no.
Are there prostitution and marital connubial duty cards? Like, is that...
That should be in the expansion.
Yeah.
Nice.
We moved then from Westeros to
space.
The far end of the galaxy.
I have to say one more thing about now that we're moving into the far end of the galaxy. George Takei was in Kansas City the past 2 days. He performed with the Kansas City Symphony on, like, a science fiction concert.
Ooh.
And Ben Watson, our most loyal fan on the Omaha Song of Ice and Fire, got to go to this concert. And I've never been more jealous of anyone in my life.
So what was George Takei's contribution?
He was narrating part of the concert. So it's very much like when I went to see Star Wars in concert and Anthony Daniels is on the tour and he's narrating part of the story in between the pieces of music, which was like one of the coolest concerts I've ever been to because there was a blizzard and they called us Omaha and it was amazing.
Yes.
But I just thought that was really cool. I follow him on Facebook and he's always posting amazing
things. Getting a lot of mileage out of his personal anti-Twilight campaign.
Yeah, he's pretty amazing. But I figured since this is our like television and what is the future of science fiction, because really the sci-fi TV thing, other than Doctor Who and Star Trek, it's exploded. And now there's an entire network, you know, the Sci-Fi Channel, and that is all they.
Well, it exploded and then it shrank.
Because it used to be good.
I think it had a peak in the 90s when there was like multiple Star Trek series overlapping, and Stargate was Star kind Dog, of the the main. I think after it moved from Showtime to the Sci-Fi Channel, and Farscape was going, also supported by the Sci-Fi Channel. And there were other oddball ones out there too, like it's not sci-fi really, but like Hercules and Xena were both on. It was like just a good time for genre TV, I guess.
Xena was so bad. Well, Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Buffy the Vampire Slayer is right in there too. Yeah.
Riley and I are on like episode 45 now, and we tried to watch Xena. And we watched the first episode, and she was like, "Mom, this is horrible."
They had that for a brief time. They had The Adventures of Young Hercules. And there was a young Xena and young whoever that blonde girl was that was around.
Like, Gabriella?
Yeah, it was like the young versions. Of, with that's where Ryan Gosling was like, that's where he first started getting, he played young Hercules anyway, which was equally as horrible.
Hey girl, I'm young Hercules. Hey girl.
Yeah, I couldn't stand to watch those shows. I mean, they had a certain charm, I guess. But I mean, it's just like, let's watch a bunch of New Zealand stunt people.
See, that part of it was cool. There's a documentary about Zoe Bell, who did all the stunts for Xena. I watched that and enjoyed it very much, watching how they set up a bunch of Xena stunts, but I can't watch the show. I just can't. It was so bad.
But then, so What's-His-Face from Hercules was on Gene Roddenberry's Andromeda.
Right.
Which was another attempt to let's reinvent Star Trek.
Right, but not put it in the Star Trek universe.
It's based on another Roddenberry story or concept for a show or something. Sci-fi fans are... What's Babylon 5? It was a huge one. I never watched that show either. Yeah. I mean, anybody Babylon 5?
I didn't watch any of it.
Apparently, it had something... I think it would have appealed to Battlestar Galactica fans, in a sense. Because it was more about character than weird sci-fi event of the week, or, you know. But I can only speculate. I had a sense of what it was like, but it was just a little too cheesy and poorly acted looking to appeal to me. But I think if you look past it to the story, which you have to do a lot of times with science fiction,
right,
for screen adaptations, because, you know, you get some attractive soap actress and, you know, just good-looking performers that have no interest in the genre material, you know, and
unfortunate.
And just, you know, let's just go to the sci-fi rack and pull, you know, wardrobe that's been used in a half dozen other half-assed performances.
Right.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of that you see out there, too.
I think that's why I never was into it when I was younger, because it was shows like, you know, Xena and everything you just described. When I first started getting really into it, it was things like Lost and Firefly and things like that that I found myself able to relate to more, because it was like seemingly normal people in these other, you know, and that could be described as fantasy. I mean, Firefly is all about being in space, but there's this particular quote that Wash and Zoe, where he says something, they're in this situation, and Wash says, "That sounds like something out of science fiction." And she says, "You live on a spaceship, dear."
Yeah.
Where I'm constantly commenting on the genre and commenting on the fact that it's a Western, but it's in space. But you know, it's this and it's that, but it's not green men talking to some dude and we're all wearing the same uniform. It's not like that.
Right. But Joss Whedon's good at sprinkling in a little bit of meta humor like that into all his shows, I think.
Yeah. I mean, starting off Dr. Horrible with the evil laugh, and he's like, "So that's coming along." I mean, you know, right away he's commenting on this thing. And I mean, speaking of Joss Whedon, like, that guy, he's done so much for... We talked about him a little bit last time, but the fact that he's had these love-hate relationships with the networks and the things that he's really believed in, the networks haven't, and it's no secret that there's, like, constantly a Whedon battle going on with some network. And when the writer's strike was going on and they decided to do Dr. Horrible the way that he wanted to do it, it was this breath of fresh fucking air, man.
Like, check it out if you haven't seen it.
It's one of the best, in my opinion, it's one of the best things that's been produced in the past, however many years ago it was produced, because of the fact that it was this musical about a wannabe supervillain.
Yeah.
And
the only science fiction slash pseudo comic booky musical I've ever heard of. Well, I guess Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark, but let's just not talk about
it. No. Because this was something that would have, like, it would have been picked up by a network had the network been smart enough to do so, and had he not have been giving the middle finger to every one of them.
I think that the networks have turned down an awful lot of good ideas from Joss Whedon.
Yeah.
Exactly. And this was his, like, hey, fuck you. I don't need you. I have this thing called the internet now. And then, I've not experienced this, and someone told me I was crazy for not, but I didn't realize that if you buy the DVD, there is Commentary the Musical. The little Asian chick who's interviewed a couple of times when they're like, oh my god, it's Captain Hammer, she wrote a lot of it, and they have her on there singing about how the fact that she was gonna star in it, but nobody wanted to watch a little Asian girl, like it had to be somebody like Felicia Day in order for it to do what it needed to do. And
isn't she that Asian girl from those Disney programs, like the Disney Channel? Is that the same one?
I don't know.
The one that was in The Social Network?
Yes.
I don't know.
Obsessive girlfriend.
The psychotic girlfriend.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
I have not seen Commentary the Musical, and I need to. I think that's something that we should all watch together.
That'd be awesome.
That would be fun. But, I mean, Riley, you guys know Riley. She's obsessed. She knows every single word to every single song. And we were at dinner, and I had people over that didn't really know each other very well, and somebody said the words bad horse.
Bad horse.
Bad horse. And Riley didn't even miss her cue. It was bad horse, bad horse, bad horse. He's bad. He rides across the nation in the thoroughbred of sin. I mean, just the entire thing. And the only time I put my hand over my face is when she said, he'll make you his mayor. And I was like, oh, God. Oh, God. Oh, God. And then it was over.
Well, I missed out on all of Buffy. You know,
it's not too late, Chuck.
It's on. Well, I've tried to. I watched the first two episodes, and they were horrible. And it's like if this show doesn't improve quickly. But I know just from everybody else talking, just the fervent fan devotion, you know, to specific episodes that happened, like season four,
season two of Buffy was where it started to actually like get good for me. When I was, I actually didn't watch past season two, but I liked season two.
I like what they're doing. It's getting more adult now that they're all like seniors and they've cheated on each other and people are becoming witches and this witch is dating this werewolf and like Seth Green, the addition of Seth Green to the whole thing, like him playing Oz is very, very cool. I really like him.
It's becoming more adult now that they're all seniors.
Like, there's the potential of sex. It's not
were
like
they, were
oh
they
God, we're
were they only seniors for 1 year though?
Not Oz.
Like I for whatever reason, I watched a couple of seasons of Smallville, and
high schoolers.
And then I would check in on it. I would just watch a few minutes of an episode here and there. But I'm pretty sure Clark was a senior for like 6 years.
Shows were
totally.
it's fluff. It's total fluff. But it's it's great. And like the clothes, I can't get over how bad the clothes are and the shoes, especially. I know that's a stupid thing to say, but I'm a girl. And
no,
like,
that's important.
I have not. Every episode, we're like, oh my god, please fire this person. This is awful. Like, Sarah Michelle Gellar is wearing flood pants the entirety of the show. And
Elsa and I have watched a lot of episodes of Chuck, and she is the same way about the wardrobe they give to whoever the blonde super spy character that's on that show. She's who dresses this character? No, she would never wear that.
I know. She's wearing a pleather dress. Jesus.
During the original run, I did watch one episode of Buffy that I thought was pretty clever. It was she was just going to college for the first time, I believe, and so just meeting her new college roommate to live in the dorms with, and it was like, oh, you know, I have the college roommate from hell. But of course, it turned out to be an actual demon from hell.
Well, right.
So I thought that was pretty clever.
The musical episode, a friend of mine who I went to undergrad with forced me to watch it, and I never watched any other Buffy episode.
Yeah.
That episode was, I mean, it was one of the funniest things.
It's hilarious.
What's happening to the town? And they look out the window, and they got the mustard out, and then all this dancing starts happening. They got the mustard out. closes the blinds and she's like, oh my god, we have to do something. So it's...
There's a lot of sci-fi television shows, and it hasn't been till recently that it seemed to be that there's, you know, fantasy television shows. And, it, you know, it kind of seems like maybe it was just like Star Trek worked. Maybe we, you know, and network execs are like, maybe this is going to be the next big Star Trek.
But like, why? Lost?
Yeah. Why does it seem like science fiction shows seem to be more successful on television?
Well, like Stargate and Mystery Science Theater 3000 and Firefly and all these things, like, they just last forever. Farscape, mm-hmm. It's like you're in the universe, and as long as you're in the universe, they can have nice, happy episodes that have a beginning, middle, and end, and everything goes back to normal at the end of each episode.
I saw something the other day that kind of reminds me of your question there. Okay, you know the whole discussion about how fantasy, you know, is usually set in some sort of alternate world or something like that, whereas science fiction usually is somehow based on our world or some sort of futuristic thing. There was something, that's what it was. I watched the trailer for the Hobbit online or something, and somebody had posted a comment, and there are people, I've talked with people, that they just, it doesn't click with them. They said, I've never understood what timeline this story is supposed to be in. Is this supposed to be in this period or this period? Is this supposed to be an alternate dimension? I'm like, they don't get the concept of just creating a whole different world. They don't get it. And so I wonder if that... I think maybe in that way science fiction is more accessible to some people because they can think, oh, it's just the future.
Right.
And so... Okay.
Or like with Lost, it's like this place and you know that it's part of our our universe, but we don't know how or how it's accessible.
The physics of it are crazy.
Yeah. Right?
There's a smoke monster.
Okay, I have to talk about Terminator Sarah Connor Chronicles because of my huge Terminator thing that I have.
You? What?
I have a Terminator boner. That the show itself...
Boninator.
Like, okay, the show itself did kind of ignore the Rise of the Machines movie. Like, it just kind of pretended it didn't happen. And
not a lot of us do.
Was Rise of the Machines the third one?
Yeah.
It sort of acknowledged that it could have happened.
Yes.
But they do a time jump that prevents that eventuality.
Thank the Lord. They were like, oh, we don't actually have to have that movie because look how we can fix that.
Well, yeah. in Rise of the Machines, Sarah Connor has died of cancer.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And in the Sarah Connor Chronicles, they hint she gets early diagnosed, mm-hmm. Looks like you have cancer.
So it's sort of canon.
And
kind of canon.
Yeah, right. Okay. It could have existed there. But what was so cool about Terminator is because they did stuff like that, and of course it had to end. Like, I was so mad. I still have the last episode on my DVR downstairs. I totally do. But the very last episode, have you guys watched it? Is this going to ruin anything?
Go ahead, because I've heard so much about it already.
I'm sorry.
No, it's not just for me.
You can still get into it.
In every single Terminator movie, nobody ever talks about John Connor, like, being raised... when the actual, I'm just going to call it apocalypse for lack of a better word, when Skynet takes over, nobody ever talks to him about, like, him living through that. Do you know what I mean? It was just like, there was this guy and he was there all of a sudden, right? And I never thought about that until the very last episode of the TV show when he time jumped from where he was in the present before Skynet had taken over into, like, the thick of the war. And it was just all of
but
a sudden.
But as
was
a teenager
right there.
Still.
As a teenager still.
I didn't quite take that as he becomes the leader of the resistance as this teenager from out of the blue. I think I think they were still going to play it like he lays low. He befriends these characters without really letting them know who he is or where he's from.
Right. I mean, he's not just going to burst in and be like, I'm John Connor and I know what to do. But
and you're my dad and you're my dad's brother.
But, you know, he did, like, those were the first faces he saw when he got there was that. And and it was... Who are you?
No, it was a mind-blowing, awesome cliffhanger.
Beautiful. It was so beautiful. And what's me being as Terminator thoughtful as I am, like that, the fact that that show was able to surprise me up to the very last moment,
that show
was super refreshing.
Introduced a lot of good concepts that did not... I mean, you just sort of assume, you know, time travel Terminator, this is a dead end of a story already.
Yeah.
And, hell no.
But they breathed a lot of life into it while... simultaneously sort of dragging their feet on moving the story forward in a lot of ways, too.
But the Cromartie thing and the Shirley Manson was such an interesting layered character. And the whole Kyle Reese's brother, Derek, I thought that was really cool. And you didn't know if Jesse was actually, what side she was on. And when you find out that this weird girl that John has befriended is actually, like, sent back to hurt them, but she can't because now she has this kind of, like, it's just so human. The whole thing was so human. And Cameron, Summer Glau, holy shit. Holy awesome shit. Mm-hmm. Like, when she does the ballet, when she realizes that she's good at that and she, like, does it of her own accord in her bedroom, like, puts on the ballet shoes and dance. It was so creepy.
I didn't think her character would be as interesting as it ended up being.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, they did the female Terminator in Rise of the Machines, so of course they have to do the female Terminator who's good. But, I mean, she was really enigmatic. You never really understood what her intentions were. I mean, she was clearly self-aware. She's clearly had her own agenda, but at the same time, she was... You never really knew if she's just following programming or if she was kind of making up her own mind what she wanted to do. It was very interesting.
Yeah. That show was so good. And Bear McCreary did the music for it.
Oh, he did?
He totally did. I have the soundtrack in my car.
So does it... I think this might be a good thing to talk about since we're talking about TV. Does the same reason that sci-fi in movies works for you, is that are those the same reasons that it works on TV for you, like, or, you know,
different reasons?
Is it better as a TV show or as a movie?
TV is all about investing in character development, mm-hmm. and movies are all about spectacle and wrapping things up in a nice 2-hour package,
right?
Kind of.
I don't like either TV or movies that are predictable because I don't understand why I'm watching them if I already know what's going to happen. We watched Real Steel last night, which is kind of cool. It's like 2027.
It's supposed to be a crowd pleaser.
It is a crowd pleaser. I mean, it's Rocky with robots, but they're, every single thing that happened, I would turn to Saul and be like, okay, now is the time when all the people he owes money to show up because they saw him on TV.
Right.
Oh, wait.
Okay.
Now's the time. He's going to get beat up in front of his kid. And every single thing that happened, I was like, now's the time when this will happen, and it happened. So
right.
It wasn't that it wasn't good.
But it's still enjoyable to watch that, despite the fact that they sort of telegraphed every plot point from a mile away, right?
I mean, we were drinking, so it was fun. I don't know if it would have been fun if I was just
that's what I had read about
it.
It's like, you know exactly what's going to happen, but you don't care because it's a fun ride.
I think that's kind of like, for me, it's like, you know, sometimes if there's a cool enough premise, I can get over the fact that it might be a really horrible movie or a horrible television production. You know, like, I kind of want to see CGI robots boxing. You know, no matter how bad of a movie
the metal
Real Steel
cool.
might, you know? So.
But then you run the risk of, like, oh, okay, well, I expect that this is going to happen because this happens, and then it doesn't. And then you're like, wait a minute. Am I smarter than you? Because they made this huge deal about, like, this robot, this particular robot had a shadow effect, which means if it was seeing the person that was in control of it, it would mimic the movements. So they had this big deal about this robot dancing before it got into the ring, right? And it was this huge deal until the biggest fight of the entire movie, and the robot didn't fucking dance, and I felt cheated. I totally felt cheated. I'm like, you've built up, like, little dance, bigger, big dance, and now you have the opportunity, and they didn't even do it.
That just sounds like bad writing right there.
Why I, like, lost so much up until the last, like, 8 episodes, or the last season, really. Because it surprised the shit out of me,
right.
You know?
Lost, it was the most exciting sci-fi thing I've seen on TV since the original Star Trek, I think.
Yeah. I would agree. Lost was actually, until I saw Battlestar Galactica, Lost was my very favorite television show ever, and then Battlestar Galactica kicked it out of
the
water.
Are you taking out the last, like, how it ended?
I think that that's a whole nother episode if we want to go into my theories on
Lost. I just
Lost.
Mean, is it still the greatest even though it ended the way it ended?
It was.
Okay.
Until Battlestar Galactica came along and I saw the Battlestar Galactica finale.
Okay.
And that's how a canceled show wraps up an entire era of storytelling in that genre, you know? Anyway, I loved Lost, and then Battlestar Galactica came on long and kicked its ass.
Yeah, it did.
When I was watching Lost, I was really heavily into the producers' podcast. Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse would release these podcasts every week after the show, kind of answering fan questions and giving a little teaser to the next episode. And they always talked about how if the season got canceled early, they would have a chimpanzee called Bobo come out and just tell, you know, all the things that they were trying to build up. And I kind of feel like that still needed to happen with that show. Because I think that, like, the way they ended it was a very good contained storyline, but there were still so many things that it was like, we need Bobo to come out and explain here.
Both Lost and Battlestar Galactica ran the risk of making the same mistake that the X-Files did,
mm-hmm.
was early on in all three series, they start planting mysterious sort of teasers of something really far out is going to happen. There's something really interesting and mysterious happening here, and we're going to get to the bottom of it. And on the X-Files, they never ever did. And but so Battlestar and Lost both found ways to explain the stuff that they planted early and didn't really have an answer for themselves. Yeah. I mean, they said, oh, this would be really mysterious. Let's just do this. And what does it mean? We'll figure that out later.
Right.
Let's get picked up for a second season first, and then we'll worry about that.
Right.
I think both of those shows did that, and, you know, it's arguable to what varying degree of success they did. Excuse me.
I haven't seen Lost yet, but for me, the reason I loved the ending of Battlestar was it. I think the show stayed true to itself mm-hmm. up until the end, in that the finale of Battlestar, yes, that, like, it didn't necessarily give you a lot of technical answers to certain things. Like, I mean, there's the whole Starbuck resolution, but I personally love the Starbuck resolution.
Me too.
At first, I didn't know what I thought of it, but then after I thought about it for a while, I really liked it, and it's because what I liked about it was in the finale was I thought they set it up brilliantly in taking the character stories and showing us the stuff from even before the beginning,
yeah.
and then showing how the characters end, and just that's what the whole show was about, was these characters. But I liked that they explained almost everything, but throughout the series there's this whole element of mystery of whether there's a, you know, a greater power,
the
a presence
or
whatever looking out for them. And what I love about the Starbuck resolution is they resolve it, but they leave it in mystery,
mm-hmm.
and which is effective to me, because anytime you deal with something that deals with life and death and what lies beyond, I think it's better left in mystery rather than trying to give it a technical explanation. And so that's why that ending was so powerful to me. And at first I wasn't, you know, at first, yeah, I had that slight reaction of, oh, well, it was all like, but what happened? But then I thought about it, and I was like, no, that makes... Okay, yeah.
But that was there from the very beginning. Battlestar never let you think that you knew more than they did. Like that... Mm-hmm. Okay, the boxing episode, yeah, it gets a lot of flack for being that boxing episode, but you know what they did? They took us back and they showed us a bunch of shit that we didn't know.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And
yeah.
we needed to know, but we didn't think we needed to know. But it
yeah.
was like they kept control yeah. over, this is what you know, this is what we need you to know right now, but we want you to know that you don't know everything.
Yeah. Eric and I do have the series of Lost on it. We inherited it from somebody, and we're going to be watching it sometime when we're finished with everything else.
Good.
That we have to catch up on.
Which never happens, because three more shows will
yeah,
pop up.
Exactly.
What I liked about Lost was the whole, they were very open about what inspired them
mm-hmm.
to do this, and mm-hmm. I did the whole Lost book club thing on the website. They had, like, this episode is inspired by this piece
yeah.
of literature or whatever, so I started reading a lot of, you know, I read The Fountainhead, and I read
right.
a bunch of other stuff that was on their list as inspired literature.
All of the extracurricular activities that went along with Lost, that to me is what it made it like a singularly unique, brilliant show, is there were so many Easter eggs and
mm-hmm.
references
yeah.
and,
they had those,
and homages and things in every
real
single
life games in between a couple seasons where you could find out different things on different websites.
Exactly,
and,
exactly.
Yeah.
The
experience, the Lost experience.
The Lost
is what
experience,
they call it.
Right. The online stuff
mm-hmm.
and even publishing novels that like took place within that universe. Or I mean, there's just so many, there's the mystery was so fascinating, and there's just so many interesting tidbits that I almost don't think you can relive the Lost experience just by watching the episodes
no.
on DVD. Because just that having to wait a week till what comes next and pouring the internet for all the tidbits and, you know, or like podcasts. Like I found Lost Casts halfway through. I don't even think they did the podcast until like season two was over.
Yeah.
But by
I
the time
so.
Season three started, it was just so fascinating that you couldn't not, like, okay, let's process this episode. Let's see. There's a map. Let's do the freeze the screen on the map that you can see for 2 seconds on the show, and make a put it up on the internet, and let's just parse mm-hmm. it. And okay, so this is where the hatch is, and this is where that other
swan.
Hatch is, and yeah, this is the Swan Station, and what does this all mean? All of that was just so fun. I mean, it was like a once in a lifetime thing to just
yeah.
ride that experience of that show.
Definitely.
As it was being produced.
And the actors, like, the acting is pretty phenomenal. There were two people from Lost in Real Steel. It was just neat.
Evangeline Lilly?
Yeah, and you know what? Even though she, I think you mentioned this on one a podcast earlier, that she, even though that show was science fiction, she, Kate's character had, like, the least contact
mm-hmm.
with anything fantasy other than being on the island and whatever. But it makes sense that she's the one who gets cast in the sci-fi films.
Well, that happens over and over again with sci-fi actors, is they even though they probably would love to go on to, you know...
other things.
Do Meryl Streep-type roles, they still they take what they can get. So that's why Summer Glau goes from Firefly to the Sarah Connor Chronicles.
Well, Dollhouse.
Yeah. Well, and even look at, like, Zoe Saldana, who was in, you know, she was in the Star Trek movie, and then she was in Avatar, and... she had that, what, Coriana movie that's not... I don't know if it's sci-fi. I haven't seen it.
No, it's not. It's You Killed My Father.
Yeah. But, you know, it's like there seems to be... it's like, you know, you get in a sci-fi thing. It's like you're a sci-fi hero or you're a sci-fi...
Well, you've got fans for life.
Yeah.
If you can pull off a great sci-fi show, you've done something... you've accomplished something...
Lucy Lawless.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. There were some Battlestar videos, like behind-the-scenes videos... and they'd have, like, Lucy Lawless, and she's, like, in her robe, like, drunk or something, and they're like, excuse me, the extras food is over there, and she's like, but, you know, she would make these really silly videos where, like, people didn't know who she was, or like, you're in my way, get out of my way, and, you know.
One of my favorite blooper videos from the blooper reels of Battlestar Galactica is all the references of Felix Gaeta hitting on all the other male members of the crew.
Nice.
Like, there's this thing where he's trying to get into, like, the Admiral's quarters or something, and the guard is all like, I'm sorry, sir, I can't let you through. And Gaeta's like, you have lovely eyes.
Yeah. It's like...
In the last season DVD, there's a music special.
Yes.
And a guy who... I know, gave me the season 4 music special, and he's like, watch this, I think you'll really like it. And the whole thing is like a spoof video they're interviewing all of the cast of Battlestar about the music, and they're like,
what
there's
music?
No music in this
you
show.
Mean the drums?
What are you talking about? The drums? Whatever, there's no music. And there's a scene where like Adama and Ty are like, it looks like they're off to the side of the set giggling like little girls, and they're like making fun of it. And it's so funny. It's so funny. And like Bear McCreary, you know, you see him, like, struggling composer, and then at the end of Battlestar, he's, like, waking up with bras on his desk and, like, like chicks everywhere. It was just so funny. I didn't really learn anything, but it was funny.
So where do we think sci-fi with television is going in the future?
In the future?
It's like if we look at kind of...
Well, how many shows have there been trying to recreate the magic of Lost?
I don't know. Let's look at the
since yeah. Since that schedule. When there was that one that came out, Happy Town, and there was
Happy Town.
Yeah, it was on ABC. It was like it's called Happy Town, but it's not. Like that was the premise. You know, it's not a happy place.
What?
And it had
Did
one
you
of
make
the
that
others.
Up?
I didn't. It had one of the others from Lost.
Absurdist
on it.
Science fiction.
Yeah, there was a couple. There was a couple of them that came in the wake. Flash forward. V.
That was so awful. Well. One thing happened, and it took a minute and a half. And now the rest of the season, we're gonna speculate.
Yeah.
Oh,
was that
man.
Flash forward or the incident? Was there a show called The Incident?
I don't know.
Or is The Incident what they refer to?
I think it's
Flash
what they
Forward.
Refer to in Flash Forward.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, it was like Lost got canceled, and right before, you know, during the final season, there was all these, you know, promos of different television shows of Flash Forward, V. There was like two or three more, and I remember seeing them. Like, they're trying to keep Lost fans. They're trying to make sure that they still get that viewership.
Well,
J.J.
Abrams did the Alcatraz thing,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
With
theoretically, that's the spiritual successor to Lost, right?
Right, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which we're only... I haven't watched it yet, but I've recorded 3 episodes. So maybe that's the direction, is just more of that, but hopefully at least one of them will do it well.
Face-Off. I mean, they're doing things like Face-Off, which is a super awesome...
Not the movie, but this is
no,
reality,
I mean,
show.
Reality show, yeah.
And that, I mean, that's kind of a huge industry, the horror makeup and the sci-fi makeup. Those people are really good at what they do.
That seems like the only thing worthwhile that the sci-fi channel has on their
docket for the next few years.
Well, is Caprica still going?
No, Caprica's not.
It was canceled after the first season.
Which... next year... No, sorry.
They're coming out
year,
with Blood and Chrome.
Blood and Chrome, yeah. Which is the prequel.
It's the first Cylon.
Oh,
the first
hell
Cylon
yeah.
War. Yes.
This is my problem with sci-fi. And granted, a lot of this was from Cracked.com's article about how sci-fi used to be awesome and now it sucks. And so I don't know how you know, legit Cracked is when reporting facts, but some of the things seemed legit. But they talked about how there was a regime change when they started spelling sci-fi differently. It was in reflection of the regime change, somebody taking over and saying basically that their audience used to be nerds in their basement watching sci-fi, you know, old sci-fi stuff on the Sci-Fi Channel, and they didn't want to attract that audience anymore. And so they started putting wrestling,
being
and,
human,
yeah, and weird things under that weren't that for some reason they thought would attract an audience that wasn't just nerds in their basement. When if you have a channel that's directed to science fiction, it would seem like you alienate your audience by saying you don't want to make programming for them. I don't know. So my hope for the future of sci-fi is that it can with stuff like Face Off. It can get back to its, you know, that really glorifying the fact that there's so many people out there that love that kind of stuff, whether or not it's bad programming.
Do you remember the commercials before they changed the name and it was like something creepy or crazy would happen and it would mm-hmm. be like, sci-fi.
Yeah.
They were really cool. Oh, like, they were super imaginative.
Very, very clever, yeah.
And ever since the name change, there has been like a staleness to
Well,
I have...
Oh,
no, I was just going to say it's a perfect example of like the evil corporate executive... Just like, all right, I got myself a TV channel now.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's all about reality shows. You know, forget... I mean, whatever, like, Spike...
mm-hmm.
It's like Spike or whatever.
Yeah.
Or there's, like, no... Or MTV. Great, we don't have to do music videos anymore, really. Let's just do reality shows. And the History Channel, we don't really have to show old history documentaries. Let's do reality shows. Yeah, it's just it's sad.
But I am hopeful for the future because, especially right now, if you look at some of the networks, there's a lot of good stuff that's out there. You know, like American Horror Story, or on a slightly less better level, the Once Upon a Time. I haven't seen Grimm at all yet, but it seems like there's more of as we as a culture, as a society, seem to be more accepting of quote unquote geek or nerd. Proclivities such as, you know, science fiction and fantasy, there seems to be more of like, okay, we can put this on TV and there will be people that watch it and we can put money into it and make it good. So I have a hope that we will see some really great stuff in the future on TV.
I think all the people that grew up watching all the stuff that we grew up watching are the people that are now producing stuff, right?
Yeah.
So I think you see like everybody in Lost... There's a Star Wars reference here. There's, you know,
right.
We talked about that in the last one. He rewrote Empire.
Yeah, so the Ewoks.
He took that chance, man.
The thing that bugged me about Hurley is he wasn't trying to rewrite Empire. He was trying to write it the same way that it was. He was trying to remember what actually happened in the Empire.
Wasn't he trying to make it better though? There was a moment where they were like, "This didn't happen."
He was trying to write out the Ewoks, is what because he hated the Ewoks. Much like it's like I remember loving the Ewoks, you know, because I saw it as a kid. But I hated Jar Jar Binks. Well, when Jar Jar Binks came out, there were so many kids that loved Jar Jar Binks. So it's like he was trying to get rid of the Ewoks. Like if I would have rewritten, you know, the first three that came out most recently, I would not have had Jar Jar Binks. You know what I mean?
Yeah. If anybody can go back in time.
Yeah, but the Ewoks were costume. Jar Jar Binks was CGI. Yeah. So fuck that.
Misa no like that motherfucker.
I stepped on one of your.
I wanted to. Speaking of, you know, just the future of science fiction, and then we were talking about spin-offs. I'm getting all socio-political here for a second.
Do it.
I wanted to thank Caprica for having a major supporting character, a mafia hitman who can, you know, slice your throat and kill you, who is gay and in a happily married relationship, and they don't make a fucking big deal about it. Thank you for that. Thank you. I just, seriously, that was such a breath of fresh air to me because I'm so sick of, like, you know, there was some movie, I don't remember what movie it was, you know, some movie where, like, The Rock was like some hitman and he was gay and they made a big foo-foo deal about it, and it pissed me off so fucking much.
The sequel to Get Shorty and Be Cool. Yeah.
Yes. Anyway.
The only other time that I've seen somebody, because I love that character. But,
okay.
His name is Adama's brother.
Oh, yeah. Sam
Adama.
Right, yeah.
Sam Adama. The only other time that I've ever seen a character like that where it was just like, well, I mean, it was a little... They kind of made a big deal about it because it was Julia Roberts. But the Mexican.
I was going to say the Mexican.
With James Gandolfini as like this super James Gandolfini character, but he's gay. When I started watching Caprica, that was one thing that we had talked about. It's like, it's so awesome that what they're basically saying in their show is that the writers and producers are like, this is just a natural thing.
In this society.
If you know, spoiler alert, where Battlestar Galactica came from, and that Caprica and all that was like before humanity. It's like, well, it's been going on for millennia. It's something that just happens. Anyway.
So, I think that's just the tip of the iceberg, hopefully, is just the idea of gay characters just existing in the world of the story without it having to be a plot point of the story.
Yeah.
And I think that actually is a very good use of science fiction. You know what I mean?
Way to be progressive there, you know, and so, anyway.
Yeah, the future, maybe treating everybody equal. Oh, holy shit, what would that do? Only in the world of science fiction can we not make a big deal out of it. I have to tell you guys my MacGyver moment.
MacGyver.
Okay, so Stargate, which we haven't talked about, but, you know, it's inevitable that it comes up, Stargate. I don't know all of the, like, SG, whatever. There's a show, Stargate, whatever. So, and MacGyver was the main dude, right, for a while?
Yeah.
I think my mother has always been a little bit in love with that guy, Richard Dean Anderson.
Yeah.
Because I remember seeing him at Romeo's once when I was a kid, and she made me go over and ask for his autograph. And I did.
You got MacGyver's autograph?
Yeah, I don't even know. I don't know. I don't remember this. But there's, like, a thing where it's, like, him, and he's sitting there, and I have his autograph, and my mom said she made me go, and I was, like, 3 or something.
Right.
So, I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe she made that up. I don't know. But still, I'm not even watching Stargate. I'm flipping through channels, okay? I wouldn't watch Stargate. I'm sorry. But flipping through channels. And whenever there's, like, a standoff, I'll stop and watch what's going on. So there's a standoff in Stargate. Richard Dean Anderson and the cute blonde chick are, like, sort of up against the wall, and they're hiding, and they're, like, talking through strategy to get out of the mess that they're in. And he's like, I need this and this, and we're going to do this and this and this and this. And she goes, who do you think you are? MacGyver? And he looked at the camera and did one of those shoulder shrug, like, I don't know. And I swear to God, like, it's just me and, like, a moment in the life. I'm flipping. Ooh, standoff. I need this and this and this. Who do you think you are? MacGyver? Shrug. And I went click, click, click. Like, I kept going. But it was one of those, like, did that just happen? That just happened. In front of me. By chance. Thank you, MacGyver and Stargate, for confirming why I don't watch that show.
Too corny.
Anyway.
There was a weird thing about him on that show. It seemed like for about, I don't know how many seasons he was on. Let's say like 6 or 7. For like the last 3... he was desperately trying to get off the show. And they kept talking him into sticking around. So his character got really sort of sarcastic about what was happening in every episode.
Yeah. Way to burn a bridge, MacGyver.
I mean, it's like they wanted him around because he was great and charming and just, he was like the heart of the show for a while. But he did successfully wean himself out.
Yeah.
And it was really when they introduced Ben Browder.
Yeah.
As his successor. And he must have been, all right, I'll stick around. You've got the Farscape guy now. I'll appear like one or 1.5 seasons with this guy to get him up to speed.
I remember seeing it. That's what it just seemed like. It just seemed like he was just like tired of this. He's just like, I'm walking around.
I'm imagining like the actor's interpretations changing from like something like, yeah, we should do that, to yeah, we should do that. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, hey guys, did you see that there's a new Total Recall coming out? Did you know that?
What?
There's a new Total Recall coming out this summer.
Why?
Right?
the original's awesome.
I don't know why, but it's happening.
Okay.
And there are famous people that are in the new one.
There are famous people that are in the new one.
Damn it.
They're making a new Spider-Man already. That's only like...
Right.
Well, they're going to... Like 9 years old.
Well, come on.
How many
cover,
times
gotta
are they
going to
reboot that damn fucking franchise? Pardon my...
Oh, and there's a Batman musical.
What?
Do you know about this?
I was going to write that.
No, there's a Batman musical that they're bringing to the States next year to tour. It's been in the UK, and there's, I mean, it's like every villain. But there was a really good article in, it was either in a Variety or a Polestar magazine that I was reading that interviewed the guy who created it, and it was really cool. It was, and the stage picture that I saw was like, you see Batman, and the picture's kind of from his perspective, and he's looking in a certain direction, and the direction he's looking in, there are villains walking towards him, and it's like Two-Face, the Riddler, the Joker. What, are you looking at Total Recall?
I was looking at Total Recall, sorry, yeah. Colin Farrell is
just
Quaid.
Two-Face?
Yeah, Colin Farrell is Quaid. I knew there was a reason that I was like,
does
oh,
Two-Face
I don't
have
know
to sing
this
in harmony with himself?
I hope so.
I would. Here's the thing. I would watch, and maybe because I'm just such
Kate Beckinsale is Laurie. I'm sorry. And Jessica Biel is Melina, which...
Bryan Cranston is Velos? All right, okay.
Kate, but the whole, like, the whole Sharon Stone as Laurie, like, she was so great. And then the fact that she was so different looking than Melina, I thought was super cool. So now Kate Beckinsale is Laurie, and Jessica Biel is Melina, and I think Kate Beckinsale is hotter.
Yes, definitely.
Mm. Bill Nye is Quato.
Kate Beckinsale.
Bill Nye is Quato?
Bill Nye is Quato.
Okay, I want to
and
see
Ethan
it.
And Ethan Hawke is in it. John Cho from Lost is McClane.
Really?
McClane.
John
really?
Cho from Lost?
No, John Cho was not on Lost.
He's not on Lost.
He
I'm
was
a big
on,
fat liar.
He was
Harold
on
and Kumar.
Harold
American
Kumar.
Star Trek.
The White Cast.
Sorry,
Harold
Star Trek.
Kumar.
Star Trek. Yeah, there was a J.J. Abrams thing. Sorry. J.J. Abrams. Sorry. Sorry, John Cho.
You know, and back to the Batman musical that you mentioned, mm-hmm. I would watch a crappy Batman musical over the best Spider-Man musical ever. I'm sorry. I'm just a DC...
Over the best Spider-Man musical ever?
Even if Julie Taymor,
so
Turn Off the Dark, was good.
Yeah.
Okay, by the time this is aired, this will be announced, but I don't know if any of you guys know. I think I told you already. My friend Ben Beck and I wrote a play called Crash Boom Pow. The Shelter Belt is doing it in July.
Congratulations.
Yeah,
cool.
Yeah. And it's a comic book play. And it's villains, and the Red Dove is the heroine, and the Night Wolf, and there's the Boogeyman, and there's all sorts of... It's going to be awesome.
That's really cool.
Yeah, I'm really excited about it. But comic book play, Shelter Belt Theater, second week of July. It runs for 3 weeks.
All right, so... Sci-fi on TV, plenty of it. Dig in, folks. good, clean fun for the whole family.
We didn't talk about Fringe, but that's because it's awesome, and I have my own feelings about where it's going right now.
Fringe,
pissing me off.
I can't decide if I want to get into Fringe or not. I watched the first half of season one, and it doesn't. I don't think it's come into its own. It's too X-Files-y for me at this point.
It's so good.
But I know it gets better, but then does it get worse? Did it get canceled?
No.
Is Fringe still going?
Yeah.
I think it's up in the air right now.
No, I mean, I saw a new episode on Friday. Oh my god, they can't cancel it. He has to go back to his own universe.
No.
Damn it! He has to go back to Walter. Like, shit was fucked up over there.
Did you hear that? If you cancel, you will actually prevent that character from going back
no.
to his own universe.
Yeah.
That is the dilemma. He is not in his own universe, and they need him to stay so they can fix this universe. And I think he just decided to stay, which is stupid. He should go back.
And teenage John Connor is still trapped in the future.
He totally is.
They're never going to bring him back.
There's going to be some sort of like huge final crisis that's going to happen with every network. All of a sudden, they're going to be writing the exact same story.
It's like the Dark Tower series. You know, all these stories, they're going to connect somehow to
all
reality
of a sudden they're
someday.
Just,
they're fucking gonna hope so.
They're
going to
independently, like, film their own, like, characters' sides of this apocalypse and all the
okay.
Well, you say that, but it's funny that you mentioned right after the Fringe discussion, because isn't there some reference in a Fringe episode that it takes place in the same universe as Lost?
Really?
Same creators. I read that in a blog post. Maybe
really?
It was just one person's crackpot theory.
That's interesting.
Never really
a paradigm
took off.
Shift
that's
happening in my brain right now.
That's
hold on,
really
on.
Interesting.
That's, did they ever mention the Hanzo Foundation or
the Dharma
initiative?
No, I would have something would have clicked and I would have said
did
something.
They mention a smoke monster?
Did they ever
or a shapeshifter?
Well, I mean, conceptually, that it could have been the case.
Did they ever have, didn't have to happen. A Charles Widmore on the show?
You know, I bet the Fringe producers said, no, we don't want to bring any of that lost baggage onto our show.
Where Fringe has gone, like, it's a good story, but it's not even the story that we... It's not even the same universe that we started with. Like, there are these parallel universes and this side and this side, but, like, those two sides, Peter... done fucked it all up, and he's like, he stepped into the machine and now he's in this, and he should be not, and he can't figure out how to get back.
I like it.
It's, I mean, it's cool, but like, I need the other story to be resolved. Like, I need to know what's going on. Like, there were some horrible things, like things that were left undone, and it's also one of those shows where they don't want you to know. Well,
that's
everything.
isn't that a common complaint, is all the unresolved plot threads of any show that
ends prematurely. But it's not even like unresolved plot threads. It's like that plot has halted and we're in a completely different universe and there's other stuff going on. And he's like, no, I would really like to go home. And they're like, but we have this dilemma and we need you. And he's like, I know, damn it. Fine, I'll stay here for a little while and help you. But I don't want him to stay there. I don't care about them. So that's what's going to be their trouble, is that they're introducing us, and it's the same characters, but they're in alternate universes, and I don't care about those characters in the alternate universes, because they've done such a good job of making them not the same character.
Did you ever watch Sliders?
Sliders.
That's another Sci-Fi Channel staple.
Sliders.
What's so Sliders?
Much. It's an alternate Sliders. Universe every single episode.
Sliders is
that would
where,
make me so
I'm
mad.
I'm assuming we're not talking about food. Sliders is where Jerry O'Connell, yes?
Jerry O'Connell and his
Wait a minute.
Brother.
What's the 12-second show? Do you remember that? Where the guy would go back in time like 12 minutes and he had like 12 minutes
Oh,
or
that
8
was
minutes
yeah. Daybreak with Tay Diggs.
No, there was one
called
it was
like
28
Italian
Minutes
dude.
Or something. That was
Life
and
on Mars? That's the one where he went back to the 70s.
Maybe.
Right?
Oh my god, that looked so bad.
I don't know, I kind of want to see it.
So
Harvey
bad.
Keitel? Come on, it's
right?
Harvey Keitel.
It is.
It was. That was a weird concept.
Yeah.
Let's just make a hard-boiled 1970s cop drama, but one of the cops is from the future.
And he knows that everything they're doing is actually wrong by today's standards.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, illegal.
You guys are being so
un-PC. That's actually harassment, you guys. You can't talk to women that way.
That's what I was thinking about. Like, what is their point with this show? Like, is it a science fiction show?
It's
is to
show us
I
how
understand.
Fucking stupid we were. Not very many years ago.
Which they kind of do on Mad Men, but they do it better.
Better.
Oh, it's so
way
classy.
Better. But there's no time traveling in Mad Men, at least that we know of.
That we're aware
Draper.
Of.
What is that thing
exactly.
that Joan wears around her neck? Do you think that if we... Never mind.
And now we move to phase two of wrapping up the show.
15 minutes.
Where we've all had a little bit too... Okay, anyway. Sci-fi on
sci-fi.
TV.
Watch it. It's good.
It's good.
We'll get back to it in the between seasons phase, between season 2 and 3 of Game of Thrones, when we run out of things to talk about next fall. We'll get back to sci-fi then.
And what should they look forward to next, Chuck?
Yes, of course. We've done fantasy and we've done sci-fi. We've danced around it a little bit in our discussions. So we're going to dive deep into... Horror!
I'm so excited.
So for our next few podcasts, we will get creepy with it.
We're gonna get creepy.
With it.
And now for a special segment on what has been debated as the greatest science fiction television series of all time. Join me as I sit down with Eric Grant Liana, Eric Salonis, Nicole Engels, and Ricardo Berry as we discuss why Battlestar Galactica is important to the science fiction genre, what surprised us about the show, what moments these guys will remember forever, and why frack is the best nerd curse word ever.
Battlestar is important to the science fiction genre because with how grounded it makes the story, it's easier for people to tune into the characters and it's easier for them to contemplate the themes and the issues that the story brings up. I feel like in a lot of sci-fi, like Star Trek, for example, I love Star Trek, but a lot of the way that show is presented and the way that universe is portrayed, it's very difficult for a viewer to identify with it. It's hard for them to find the parallels between the Star Trek society and our society. But with Battlestar, everything is portrayed as so similar to how we are now that it's very easy to find those parallels.
I think it's broken some serious ground as far as what people's expectation of science fiction is supposed to be or what it can be. You know, science fiction for a long time has been such a limited sector of society as far as, you know, being taken seriously. I've shown it to people who they don't like science fiction, and they like it because it's so accessible, I think. It broke ground and it made science fiction accessible in a new way that I had not seen before.
It takes a lot of the action aspect that people who don't like science fiction will like and draws them in with that, but also with those great complicated storylines that people who love literature outside of science fiction will get drawn into, and there's not so much technical babble. It's not like reading an Asimov novel that you have to know a lot of science to really get behind, but it just makes it a great science fiction story, but also an action movie and many love stories and a great work of literature.
I think it's going to be really important for the future of the sci-fi genre. There are big shoes to fill on something like this, you know. Caprica, it's, you know, it's just a different... I see where they're kind of trying to go with it, you know, but all the elements of Battlestar Galactica that made it so good was, you know, the isolation, the stresses that, you know, are put on the fleet, you know, this the Cylons. And while it's interesting to see, like, the precursor to everything, I'm just not sure it's going to really capture things. I'm going to be interested to see what's going to be coming up in the future as far as the writing, the sci-fi. You know, it's going to require a lot to reach the same level as Battlestar Galactica.
What surprised you about Battlestar Galactica?
The first time I saw Battlestar Galactica was I actually tuned in to the season one finale. And as I started watching it, what surprised me is how realistic everything looked. And a lot of the series is shot in sort of a handheld documentary shaky style camera, and I think that technique really sucked me in as I started watching. It made me really feel like I was there. And as the finale to season one drew on, I saw really awesome women duking it out, and it was exciting to watch. And then it cuts away to this gorgeous orchestrated score and these dream sequences, and everything was so beautiful to watch, but gritty and realistic at the same time. I was just captivated, and I had to watch more.
The first thing that caught me up was when Saul gave the order to close off the bulkheads and just let everyone go, even though there's so few people, and you're going to need all the resources and all the people you can get, and it's such a hard decision, and Ty had to give that order to take his people out, and it's something you see, but it was, they did the emotion so well that you couldn't help but feel really awful, like more awful than you would normally feel watching people be vented out into space, because
the most interesting thing, you know, to me at least initially, was just kind of the cinematography. And how it's shot, and kind of making this kind of large vessel just kind of dark and comfortable, which I think lends to kind of the whole philosophy of the show, and like this this whole idea of getting into somebody's head and you know, really exploring those demons and how the stresses of outer space and this whole adventure that they're on really affect these people as humans. You know, the way it's written makes things so tangible to, I think, the audience, and how, you know, people really react to this stuff. And they just took into account so many things, the language, you know, the infamous fracking and just everything about how they were able to convey these emotions in the purest way so that you can really relate and look at these people's, you know, flaws and kind of think about, like, wow, you know, like, this is how I would react, or, you know, like, yeah, I'd be taking down bottles of whiskey, you know, every night as well, you know, if you had that burden on you all the time.
The first thing that struck me when I first watched Battlestar Galactica is actually, it's a few moments within the opening miniseries, and actually they're all tied to the character of Six, actually. For some reason, she really struck me, because I'm very into the mysterious for some reason, and just the opening prologue of the series with her just appearing, walking, and just saying those opening lines, "Are you alive? Prove it." It just like set everything up for me. And then the second moment I can think of that involved her, it's disturbing. It's when she kills the infant in the, do you remember that part where she it was the look on her face as she walked away. There was like this look of like almost remorse or guilt on her face. I think she meant to, but I think it was I interpreted it as a mercy killing, basically, because I mean everything's about to go kaboom, basically. And but then finally when Six started appearing as Head Six in the middle of the miniseries, I was just all, that was seriously like what sort of like hooked me into the series, like what is going on, because I was intrigued to see this science fiction show that was suddenly taking something sort of ethereal and something unexplainable and making you, and just hooking you with it and going, I want to know the answer. And it's funny, I have some friends who watch the show who like didn't like Six because they don't understand what's going on and that pisses them off. I love mystery. Mystery always hooks me into something.
What's your favorite episode or storyline or design element or character or whatever about Battlestar, and why?
My favorite storyline was when they're in the camps and Gata's passing information, but you don't know who it is. And that made me love Gata so much that whenever I see him in anything, I kind of freak out. Not remembering all of the details, but just remembering how he was so great doing it. I loved that storyline, and it made me fall in love with Gata. Huge Gata crush.
One of my favorite characters is Boomer, and the journey that her character goes through really resonates with me in a lot of ways. Just watching her realize the truth about herself and, you know, fearing it might be true. Just seeing how tortured she is really, really gets to me. And seeing how she falls over the course of the series and turns from this, you know, really bright, hopeful character and then just crumbles into this, you know, negative sort of antagonist by the end of the series. It really affects me. And the last moment with her in the finale is when the tears start flowing for me.
One of the things I was kind of annoyed at, you know, at the beginning, or at least as things developed in the show, was kind of this whole arc of having this kind of segment, this resistance of the Cylons, you know, trying to find their own freedoms and you know, their independence and all this stuff. And I was kind of like, yeah, you know, like, it's an interesting idea, but like, I just don't know how well it's going to be executed. But what I really loved about that whole thing was when it kind of came to a head on whether the fleet, you know, wanted to trust this band of Cylons, you know, on whether or not they wanted to kind of ally with them, and in the end, you know, it kind of decide their fate, figure out whether they wanted to trust these guys or not. And I found it so interesting and so genius in some ways that the only reason that you really would have a problem trusting these entities is because they're displaying, you know, very humanistic character. You know, trust and even breaking trust is such a human thing. And so, you know, if there was a machine, it would be really easy just to be like, you know, this is what you're programmed to do. You know, this is what you're going to do. Very predictable, because you add this human characteristic into the equation. It just completely muddies up everything. And you start asking these questions on, you know, are these entities, you know, are they capable of trust? You know, have they developed that far along? As amazing as these machines are, so I just really enjoy that, especially at the kind of the end of that, you know, when things kind of all came together, and then the building of the relationship between the humans and the Cylons, you know, and them being away from the collective and how they reacted to things and being isolated with the humans and, you know, establishing that trust, which is, I mean, it's going to take years and years and years. And they made that very obvious. And they both tried really hard to make it work. So in the end, I mean, as much as I, as I didn't like the whole idea, it turned out to be just one of my favorite parts of it all.
From the very beginning of Battlestar, we are told that the Cylons look like humans, and the big scary thing is, oh my god, how do we tell our enemies from our friends? And with the character of Six and the other Cylons that are introduced early, we, you know, see that these are people, these Cylons are coming into human society, and they're from the outside. But all of a sudden, at the end of the miniseries, it's revealed that Boomer's a Cylon. Boomer, a character who, through so far in the story, has been in the midst of society and is someone who was already considered human. And when the audience realizes, oh my god, these people that we thought were human might actually be Cylons, it suddenly the Cylons aren't some other. They're part of the society, if that makes any sense. And when you watch, you know, as Boomer starts coming to the realization that she's not what she thought she was, I think it really humanizes the Cylons in a way that no other Cylon character really does. To me, Boomer, she's always stuck being the outcast. She starts out being an outcast in the human society, and that's part of what makes me identify so much with her, is, you know, that being the outcast and always struggling to fit in. And then when she is resurrected and becomes a Cylon, she's a Cylon outcast, and just her struggles to fit in are what make my heart go out to her. And that's why I love Boomer.
My favorite storyline, and maybe this sounds savvy, but the Razo and Adama love story is like one of my favorite love stories of all time. It is so untypical for a love story. There's none of the stupid, you know, there's all these romantic comedies that come out. It's just young people, you know, dating, and it's just got all this like sexual tension stuff, and like it's I don't like it. And so for them, there's this slow progression of these two people who start out butting heads and they can't stand each other, and slowly they become friends because they're in these positions where they're leading the entire human race. They're alone, and the only person they can understand is each other. And so it was so funny, like in episode 4 when you finally see them, or I mean in season 4, like when you finally see them in bed together, like I posted something on Facebook like they finally got it on or something like that. Like I just like went like nuts over it. I loved it. I think it's one of the best romances I've ever seen. My favorite, but there's a moment that I love that it expresses everything about the series to me, that how gritty yet poetic it can be at the same time. It's at the climax of Someone to Watch Over Me, the episode where Starbuck remembers the song and all that. It goes from that to Boomer taking Hera, and at the climax of all of that, with Boomer taking Hera, like, you see that there's this, they keep shooting back and forth between Boomer about to jump away, you know, the ship is in tatters if she jumps away, and the ship's gonna, you know, go kaboom, basically, like the side of it is, and at the same time you see Rosalind in her office, doing this, like, slow, like, her head, like, rises off her desk, she's getting up, and she just has this strange look on her face, and right at the climax, when Boomer jumps away with Hera in captivity, the ship, you know, the explosion happens, the side of the ship goes out, people, you know, die, and at the same time Rosalind whispers Hera's name, and she just does this, the camera just has her doing this like slow motion collapse, and it's like so poetically like beautiful. It's the whole Adama is like losing his ship and his woman at the same time, you know. It's just, sorry, I'm like getting choked up talking about it.
That is why Battlestar Galactica is the best science fiction television ever, bitches.
Battlestar Galactica is the best science fiction television series ever because it challenged the entire genre of science fiction, in that it presented science fiction in a way that was all like, this can be believable, it can be grounded, it can be dramatic, it can have great writing, great characters. It challenges every issue, I think, of human morality, too, at the same time. I mean, at the heart of the series, I think, is the question, this is my interpretation of the heart of the series, is the question, how do you determine whether something or not has a soul? Because it deals with artificial intelligence, and it deals with, you know, throughout the series, they're like, no, you're machines, and it's like, well, they're made of flesh and blood, they're displaying emotion,
how do you determine whether they have a soul versus whether we have a soul? You can't. You can only judge by something's actions, you know? And so I think what's so great about it, too, is that not only did they flesh out the themes in that way and challenge every area of morality and humanity, they also, they weren't afraid to take fully developed characters and take them places that you might not necessarily have liked, and even brought them back from that, those places. Like the character of Roslyn. She's so great at the beginning of the series. She's like this, what, you love her, and then she goes to this totally like dark place over especially later in the series, and you almost lose her, and then she comes back from that. And I love that they weren't afraid to do that. It was just very good writing, very good directing. I mean, the shots were awesome. There were some great sequences, and just very well acted and just very well thought out. And I think it challenged the idea that science fiction does not have to be, you know, this technical, for lack of a better term, nerdy thing. It can be something serious and something real and something important.
It's the best series because it's really the heart of what I feel science fiction is, and that it takes some sort of scientific or technological development and uses that to explore humanity and what that means and all the complications therein. And I think Battlestar does that beautifully. But what I think elevates it above a lot of other sci-fi is its accessibility, that it doesn't get bogged down in technical details and trying to explain things. It really sticks to exploring the human aspect and morality, and I think that is what is important, and I think that's what makes it appeal to everybody as opposed to just, you know, a specific subset of people.
Mm-hmm. So Battlestar Galactica is the best science fiction television series ever because it is, bitch.
I agree with that statement. What Battlestar Galactica did better than everybody else is basically just, it's the writing. It's the way they delivered the story. It's you know, really taking a sci-fi genre as a medium and putting in this really, really in-depth drama of how people, you know, deal with hardships and love and loss and interspecies sex and, you know, all this like crazy stuff that really, you know, there's no other way to do it. You know, I'm a massive Ronald D. Moore fan. He is like one of my favorite people like in history, just because, I mean, he's written some of like the best stuff I've ever seen on like television, like Rocks and Shoals from like DS9. I mean, he wrote like Darmok is Jalad from the original Star Trek, or Next Generation. Like, I mean, this is, the writing of that is just like so heady. Like, I love it so much. And then to hear that like he went, he started this project, you know, I was signed up right away. And just watching him develop as an executive producer and really taking the show and just holding its hand and just like finishing it, you know, it just solidifies what he is for the genre itself. Again, it comes back to the writing, just taking these interesting aspects of human nature, these characteristics, and then not just applying them to the human characters by themselves, but also then the Cylons, you know, and then just really making people human, just really just putting every flaw that they have on their sleeve, you know, and really showing how spectacular and how resilient the species is by showing them at their very worst. It's really amazing to me.
Can I go first on frack?
Frack!
Frack is the best word ever because you can use it in socially, no one who's not kind of a nerd doesn't know what it means, and so people don't really get that you're using a legitimate swear word, and it also lets other people know that you're probably a nerd, and so you can have something common to talk about. It's like when someone writes 42 down for an answer for anything, you obviously know that they are awesome. So when someone starts saying frack, you obviously know that they are awesome, and that is what makes it the best word ever. It's like a secret nerd code. Because anyone who's just like not a nerd but watches Battlestar probably doesn't use frack. But if you're a nerd and you watch Battlestar, you probably use frack on a regular basis. And that lets you know that someone is go to talk about nerd things.
Frack's just a fantastic word. You get your phonically, it just sounds dirty, you know, phonically with that hard F. You know, it could be applied every time, you know, in every sentence, you know. I've personally used frack and fracking in my own sentences at times until people kind of look at me weird, like, what are you trying to say, you know? If everybody kind of says that, you know, using F-bombs and swear words, you know, make a less intelligent speech, then I think that using frack and pretty much everything makes a more intelligent speak, because it's kind of an inside joke. And only those people who understand what you're actually saying kind of get it. No, it's just a nice word.
Frack.
Frack. You said we can interpret this question however we wanted, basically. Frack. Frack, Gata, they broke my heart. They fracking broke my heart with Gata. He was one of my favorite characters, and it was so fracking sad to see him be, you know, deceived by the fracking devil, Tom Zarek, who I fracking hate. He is like the one character. Tom Zarek is like the one character that I actually hate on the show, but I like hating him. Like, I like hating him, but I hate him. But Gata was like the biggest devastation, heartbreak thing for me on the series. Every time I think of Gata and his mutiny, I think, frack, Gata!
Frack.
I think that frack is an amazing device they used in the series as part of, you know, presenting these characters and making it accessible in order to believe these characters are acting believably in all these stressful situations. Day-to-day people are going to start throwing out curse words. But sadly, in primetime television, you can't throw out curse words. And so as a way to sort of make all these stressful situations as realistic as possible, they've got to invent curse words. Another one of my favorite sci-fi shows, Farscape, invented all sorts of curse words, but sort of the point of that show was dealing with, you know, different cultures and aliens and stuff, and so the curse words were kind of flowery and strange and alien, and so they didn't really, you know, resonate as well, and, you know, people couldn't identify with them. But frack, just the sound of it, the hard K at the end, sounds angry. And when you say frack, you know, you're really fracking serious. And so I think that because of that, frack is an amazing way to do stuff. It's awesome. I love
Mother
it.
Fracker. Like, they actually Goram. Use Mother Fracker. I love, yeah, when you can use Goram and frack in the same sentence.
Oh, man.
Ow! Nerdgasm.
My favorite use of the word frack in the series. It's when Rosalind finds out that Tori's been screwing Baltar, and Tori starts out, Laura, I'm so sorry. Your respect and friendship. And Laura finishes and she goes, mean frack. Obviously, my respect and friendship mean frack.
Frack.
You know, the existence of Battlestar Galactica is just going to be this wonderful level that people are going to be continually striving to achieve, and only greatness can come from that.
Battlestar Galactica.
Battlestar Galactica.
Battlestar Galactica.
Dark Wings, Dork Words, a Game of Thrones podcast, conceived by Chuck Davis, produced by Boombox Productions in Omaha, Nebraska, featuring Chuck Davis, Brendan J.D. Riley, Molly Welsh, and Eric Salonis, with this week's special guests, Eric Grant Leanna, Nicole Ingalls, and Ricardo Berry. Join us next time. Horror.